First case set for argument this morning is the estate of Alice Mack. It's file number 30520. Ronald Parsons will be arguing for the appellant, Robert Mack, and Joseph Erickson will be arguing on behalf of the appellees, Eric Mack and Hugh Mack. Each side will have 15 minutes for initial argument, and then there'll be a five-minute rebuttal for you, Mr. Parsons. And with that, you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and my friend at counsel's table. My name is Ron Parsons, and attorney Pamela Ryder and I are privileged to represent the appellant in this case, Robert Mack. The question that Bob respectfully raises is this: does fraud by a party's own attorney that prevented his client from knowing about and contesting the probate order that completely disposed of and settled the client's inheritance without his knowledge or participation justify vacating the final order that resulted from the fraud? Or is the defrauded client, who acted immediately upon discovering the fraud to bring a motion to vacate the order before it could be implemented in any way, just simply out of luck? On one level, this case presents a familiar tale in South Dakota. It's a probate dispute between five siblings who grew up together on a farm, involving one who stayed on the farm and worked it with his parents for his life, and four brothers and a sister who left early to go on and live their lives, as they have every right to do. But everyone returns, of course, when it's time for the farm to be divided up. Bob was the child who stayed and worked with his parents for decades. He's the only one of the siblings who wants to stay on the farm and keep farming. Even so, his parents decided in their estate plans that he would get a one-fifth share, just like every other child. And Bob's four siblings, who are not farmers, are aligned against Bob and set to receive four-fifths of the family farm and the equipment in accordance with the wishes of their parents. But on another level, this case presents a shocking and largely unprecedented scenario, I would suggest. At the time when the distribution to Bob, planned by his brothers, was to be determined by the court, Bob's attorney had never even told him that the petition had been filed. Bob's attorney never told him about the hearing that had been set before the circuit court to resolve that petition. Bob's attorney never showed up for the hearing. And when the circuit court tracked Bob's attorney down on his cell phone after the hearing was convened, the attorney, who was somewhere in another state, falsely told the court over the phone that Bob was just fine with the petition and had no objections. "Go ahead and sign the order, Judge. Bob is just fine with this." It was a lie. It was a lie to the court. Bob was not just fine with the particular distribution of clearly inferior land, unsuitable for his farming needs, and the property that his brothers wanted to give to him as his portion so they could sell the rest. And if Bob had been told about this petition and told about the hearing, he would have been there to contest it and put on evidence that the land and property they were trying to stick him with was not a fair and not an equal distribution in value.
Is there any evidence in the record, counsel, regarding Bob's attorney, from Bob's attorney? Do we have an affidavit? Is there any, what testimony exists in the record or evidence regarding from Bob's attorney?
Nothing from Bob's attorney. He was unresponsive to attempts to contact him. Had been unresponsive since the phone call hearing, where he appeared by phone call after he was tracked down during the hearing. From that point on, he was not responsive to attempts to contact him. The evidence in the record is from the other officers of the court and affidavit by Bob Mack about his interactions with his attorney, how he could never get a hold of him and was never told anything about this.
So those things that you just stated, they sounded a lot like facts, but it sure seems like what the trial court did here was made an assessment of Bob's credibility and said that is not true. Those things that you just stated are not facts, according to the court.
I would very respectfully disagree with that, Justice Myron. The only fact-finding made by the judge, and we basically put on uncontested affidavit from, our evidence was uncontested in the record about Bob's interactions with his attorney, that he had no idea about this. The court's decision, there is a suggestion that the court is unsure whether or not to believe whether Bob's appeal, which this attorney had also essentially defaulted his appeal from a civil case involving an agreement Bob thought he had with his parents that he would continue farming and get at least 50% of the farm. He brought a separate civil action. He lost that action after a jury trial. His attorney filed a notice of appeal, and then my understanding, as the record reflects, is basically that appeal was defaulted because no brief was ever filed. Bob's affidavit was that he never knew his appeal had been defaulted. In the judge's decision, the judge said, I find that hard to believe, that Bob, Bob is very interested in this, obviously. It's his entire livelihood. He never missed a hearing over 5 years in this case. Not even the simplest hearing, a scheduling hearing. And the judge said, I don't believe Bob would have probably contacted his attorney during this period regarding the appeal. That's what the court found it had trouble believing. But in terms of whether Bob had known about this hearing and the attorney had told him about the petition, the court was very careful in its decision not to make a factual finding on that.
Did the circuit court assess credibility or did it assess character?
Well, that's an excellent point. Essentially, it was a character assessment because, Bob is kind of a thorn in his brother's side, sometimes a thorn in the court's side. He's not the most agreeable person always when his livelihood is at stake. He had gotten into, he raised his voice a few times, as I understand, during some of these proceedings. He was not, no one was a fan of his on the other side or perhaps even in the courtroom.
So can we set that, whatever, if that was a credibility determination or not, let's set that aside for a minute, because it seems like at the end of the memorandum decision, the court says, I'm not really sure about this whole communication thing with the lawyer. I'm not sure what to think about that.
Right.
But then he goes on, he says, however, I conclude there's no injustice being imposed on Robert regarding the final order. And so it seems to me our ultimate assessment in this case is, was that an abuse of discretion to say, maybe there's this whole fraud thing out there. The court's not really sure what to think about that. But the court's looking at the overall process. This was a 1/5 distribution. He got his 1/5. So what's unjust about that? And so how is that an abuse of discretion?
That's an abuse of discretion because it was based on what we conclude are errors of law in assessing the standards under Rule 60B. Rule 60B is rarely used, fortunately, but it's one of the most critical backstops and fail-safes we have in the South Dakota Rules of Civil Procedure. It's basically a pulling lever in case of emergency rule. And this was an emergency because fundamentally no due process was given to our client about what happened. And the representation that this was a fair and equal distribution, that it was 1/5, was based on a fraudulent stipulation that no one disagrees. We all agree this is fair. Well, that was a lie. It was a fraud.
But don't we have to kind of set that aside for a minute and look at what was the ultimate result? Was it fair to Bob?
That's right.
And so isn't that really the ultimate question in this case?
Absolutely.
And so what was unfair about that distribution to Bob?
Because that assessment was made without evidence. There was no evidence presented because we were never given an opportunity to present evidence on that question. And we have put forward in our motion to vacate, we had another, what we contend is an uncontested affidavit that explains exactly why this was not a fair valuation. And what we would have, the evidence we would have put on at the hearing if he'd been allowed to put it on. Because, and it's undisputed, there was nothing in the appellate briefs disputing this affidavit and these points. It does not dispute that what the final order did, just based on a stipulation, was that it artificially valued the property that it was trying to stick Bob with, the worst property, the unlivable property. Bob's only wants to live there, and you can't even build a house on this property because of water and other reasons.
You it doesn't can't have run a homestead exemption. It doesn't have a homestead exemption or a home exemption.
Right. Well, that's true. Yeah.
So what you're really asking for is you're saying, give us our evidentiary hearing to show why we think this supposed one-fifth, which appears to be a one-fifth dividend or division, is not fair and equitable in this case and is unjust.
Let's put the evidence on, and that's what would happen if the court would reverse, instruct the court to grant the motion to vacate. We're back where we should have been. And Bob would get the chance he should have had all along to put on his evidence as to why this was not a true one-fifth valuation. Only Bob's fifth was carved out here. That was the plan. And later, the plan, I guess, is to sell the rest together in some kind of bundle by the other siblings. But we put on evidence that not only the property was artificially inflated, the value, by at least 10%, no inflationary increase was put on the value of the four-fifths of the property.
So Mr. Max,
20% disbalance right
there. So Mr. Max's affidavit talks a lot about the lack of communication with the lawyer.
Yes.
All those sorts of things. Does he talk about this this notion of, you know, this 10% inflation that was only attributed to him and not to the others? Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Exhibit 1 on pages 1228 and 1235 of the probate record, we put that evidence in pursuant to Ms. Ryder's affidavit and other documentary evidence during the time we filed the motion to vacate that shows this. And it shows that the property he was given, the farm equipment, he's the only one that wants to use it, was junk and unusable. And its value was even greater than it was new, even though it was old and used equipment in some cases.
So if that's the case and the court, the evidence is in front of the court, did the court really even need an evidentiary hearing? Couldn't the court look at that and say, you know what, maybe there's a 10% adjustment here. He's getting the land that he really wants versus having to go through a sale, which who knows what might happen in a sale. Maybe they'll get that 10% bump. Maybe they won't. There's going to be sale proceeds taken out of that. I think it's just. And is that an abuse of discretion?
Well, without making that decision without any evidence is, I would suggest, an abuse of discretion.
But you're saying there is evidence. You put evidence in and essentially uncontested, but the court could look at that and make a different determination as to whether that's just or unjust, couldn't it?
The court made no findings on any of our points, on any of those points, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that what that is when the court says, I conclude there's no injustice being imposed on Robert?
With respect, what the decision says is that he was entitled to a fifth, and he got a fifth, and so that's that.
And did the court, am I reading the record correctly? The court relied upon its recollection of valuations that was 2 years old, and some of the information that was offered by way of the inventory, or excuse me, the personal property was offered by way of example, not necessarily an exhaustive list of things that might be not right about it. So an element maybe of staleness incorporated into your argument in terms of the valuation, certainly for the real estate.
And that's correct. And from proceedings, which really weren't about the value of the property, from the civil trial, which was about, you know, the agreement Bob believed he had with his parents that he would get half the farm. It was really not about, the court really just said, I know this file, I've been with this file for 5 years, and so this seems like 20% to me. I mean, there was really no findings at all. And
did the court do that sua sponte, or did anyone at the hearing ask the court to take judicial notice of other findings in some of the other related proceedings?
We put on the evidence through affidavit and then argued at the hearing about this, and then the court issued later just a memorandum decision without giving us the opportunity to.
But you never asked the court to resolve that. You asked for an evidentiary hearing. You presented the affidavits to convince the court that you were entitled to an evidentiary hearing, which you never got.
Right. To persuade it to grant the motion to vacate so we could have the evidentiary hearing.
And did the court make credibility determinations from prior proceedings that are not included as part of this record?
I think the more character determinations, not really credibility, nothing. He's lying about this, he's lying about that. It's more, Bob just is not willing to go along with any of this stuff. He's been a thorn in our side. That was really kind of the argument.
So, but when the court says, uses the word credibility, not character determination, I mean, you depict it as a character determination, but the court actually uses the word, I don't find him credible.
But
on that claim.
On the claim regarding the appeal. And the court is very careful not to make a credibility finding in its decision regarding whether or not his former attorney told him about this hearing or told him about the petition.
Well the court
says, I'm unsure about that.
The court goes on at length and explains his history in the case, and then at the end says, these are just a few examples of why this court does not find the claim of Robert Mack to be credible. The claim of Robert Mack to be credible.
I think
that goes back to your argument that he's only talking about the one claim,
but
this wasn't a character assessment. And I know Justice Salter raised the idea, but I mean, the court is talking about this in terms of credibility, not I think he's a person who is unbelievable in all things. I don't believe him in this claim.
Well, I think the decision to me points directly to that he didn't believe he didn't have contact during the appeal, but it was also. There are some admissions from the attorneys for the other side at the hearing. They said, Mr. Lindgren said, I understand, Your Honor, there's no way Bob, if he'd known about this, would have missed that hearing. I was never, he would have been there. I mean, everyone understood Bob was at every single thing during this case for 5 years. And everyone was shocked when Bob was not there for the critical hearing that decided his entire fate. His entire livelihood was going to be decided at this hearing. It's really just not credible at all that he would not have been there. And I don't think anyone, I'm not sure even Mr. Erickson would dispute that. We'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Erickson, you can proceed with your argument.
It please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Erickson. I represent the estate of Alice Mack and the Philip D. Mack Testamentary Trust. I think the starting point of this appeal isn't going into the legal analysis of what happens when there is fraud, but the starting point of this appeal is, did fraud happen? And the memorandum decision describes that Robert Mack is not credible.
But is there a difference between being a good guy and being believable? Sure, the court said, yeah, right. I mean, you could be totally credible and not be awesome as a person, right?
I agree. There is a difference between being believable and being a good guy.
So if the court just says the magic words and says, that's not credible, is that enough? Or if the court says, this is why it's not credible, do we get to look at that too?
I think part of the problem with this analysis is the court is making the decision.
Do we get to look at that too?
You get to look at that too. You get to look at the credibility issue, but what you don't get to look at is all of the different records that supported the judge's decision.
So if the judge says Robert Mack attempted to control these proceedings, he agreed to things, changed his mind, then disagreed to the simplest, straightforward things, he was irascible, he was aggressive, to his mother, he's not a nice guy, so I don't believe him. Is that a non sequitur, or is that totally logical?
I think that's part of his reasoning for not believing him. And I think that's what the judge says in his decision, that these are just a few examples as to why the court does not find the claim of Robert Mack to be credible.
There are a few examples of why he's really maybe not, this is not a flattering look at Robert Mack. How does that make him not believable?
Well, what makes him not believable would be his sworn testimony in each of those proceedings in which the judge relied on. And that sworn testimony is not a part of this record because the appellant did not make it part of this record.
Were you even asking the court to make that determination?
Credibility?
Yeah. It didn't seem like that was your focus.
I'd say it was less of my focus it was part of Mr. Lindgren's focus in his argument at the hearing. He made the point of, you know, you have an officer of the court that made a representation, and the judge started to make this point throughout that hearing as well.
So, you know, when you look at the court's actual opinion, so we have these two statements referring to credibility that follow the discussion about not being credible, that he wouldn't follow up on the existing case and the failure to file a brief. But at the very end, that's where the court says, I am not, and this is specific to the issue in this case, or this proceeding, I am not certain that his claim regarding the communication is between him and his former attorney is accurate and that he didn't have notice. However, and then he goes on to decide based on the fairness of the ultimate distribution. So that's how it ends, which sure sounds to me like as to that specific issue, the court is saying, I'm not certain. However, it's a fair and equitable distribution. So notwithstanding all of that other stuff, that seems like that's where the court landed. Is that not a fair interpretation of the court's ruling?
I think the interpretation of that sentence where the judge says he's not certain has to be looked at in context of the rest of the opinion, specifically the paragraph, two paragraphs above that, on page 4 of the opinion, where he says these are just a few examples of why the court does not find the claim of Robert Mack to be credible, but, comma, even if it is true that Robert Mack had no context. So the judge writes an opinion where he doesn't, either Robert Mack is not credible and it's not true, or he is just finding that he doesn't know that it's not true. But at some level, Robert Mack needed to have a finding of fact that this fraud did occur. So if there's no finding of fact from the judge saying the fraud occurred, how do we analyze what happens when a fraud does occur? I think that's the issue with Robert Mack's position, is that he's saying, well, there was no finding of fact. He needed a finding of fact. He needed this trial court to say a fraud occurred by Attorney Donahoe against Robert Mack.
Isn't there a pretty strong implication to be drawn that he hadn't missed a hearing in 5 years, and this, so to speak, was for the whole enchilada, the distribution of his one-fifth share of the estate, and he doesn't show up at this hearing? His attorney can't be found. Were there two calls to the attorney out of state trying to locate him for this hearing? Finally find the attorney on the third call, and then he makes his representation that Bob's on board with this, no objections, etc. Isn't there an implication certainly to be drawn from that?
Right, and I believe I made the point in the hearing that that would be evidence that Robert Mack didn't have notice of this hearing. There is evidence of it, but there's also counter evidence that the judge weighed by looking at and evaluating his sworn testimony and finding what he says not to be credible. So even though there's one piece of evidence that may show that Robert Mack didn't have notice, it didn't outweigh to the trial court all the other evidence that went to why Robert Mack was not credible.
So what is the evidence that would lead the court to say that it's not true? This particular claim is not true, as opposed to what Justice Salter is suggesting, that it's a claim that this person is not believable in all things because of his character.
That's the point raised by the appellant, that, you know, these prior proceedings happened before this allegedly happened, so nothing from that could implicate that a fraud ever occurred. But when somebody's issue is at credibility to the point where you cannot be believed, and the only evidence related to this interaction between Robert Mack and his attorney is evidence from a 4-page affidavit from Robert Mack, the court didn't feel like that was enough to outweigh his credibility issues.
Well, what should they have done?
What should have done?
What should Robert Mack and Ms. Ryder, Mr. Parsons, what should they have done instead?
I think they have an adequate remedy at law against the previous attorney.
No, but I mean, should they have had something more than the affidavit? I mean, what are you suggesting?
They could have put Robert Mack on the stand at the hearing. They could have had testimony. They could have sent a subpoena out to the attorney in question in Donahoe. I mean, there was...
Well, didn't they ask for that, though? I mean, that's, in some respects, if we get past this credibility issue of whether or not anybody believes that Donahue actually got a hold of his client and told him about the hearing, you know, is there anybody that really believes that? I don't know. But let's assume we get past that issue, and then we get to the issue of really kind of narrow. We just want an evidentiary hearing on this, Judge, to hear us out on whether this issue and this distribution is just or not. And we've got to counterbalance that against the finality of judgments. People come in and file motion 60B motions from time to time, and courts. You know, the presumption is we're not just going to set those aside. That's a final judgment. Somebody supposedly consented to that. And now the court has to make that determination. So let's assume he's kind of drilled past the fraud and said, I think there's enough here, but I don't find that unjust. So if we get past the credibility issue, what's the prejudice to your client? And what issues should we be thinking about in terms of why the court did not abuse its discretion in saying, it's all over. I don't care about the fraud. There's just no injustice here. And why do you think that that's not an abuse of discretion?
Well, I don't believe it's an abuse of discretion because Robert Mack is getting his one-fifth share of the estate assets. And the counterpoint to that is, well, one-fifth of what value? I mean, I understand that's the appellant's counterpoint. So they want to have an evidentiary hearing where we then have litigation over the value of these different assets. I think the problem is the law constricts what these 60B motions can do.
Did you dispute this affidavit testimony and the exhibits that said, hey, they increased this by 10% on my land, not the rest of it. My fifth, I got a 10% bump. They didn't do it on mine, and essentially $100,000 difference.
Right. It is disputed. The affidavit of Eric Mack talks about how we're giving him one-fifth of the assets.
But that was a really conclusory affidavit. I mean, there were no specifics in there. Wasn't it just the statement that you basically said? There was no specific answer or counter to those particular valuation issues in his affidavit before the court, was there?
And the issue with going through each specific valuation issue is then you're going right into the issues that have already been resolved by the judgment. And a Rule 60B motion does not allow relitigation of issues that have been resolved by the judgment.
Well, but that's my point. When I was asking you what they should have done, I mean, to get 60B relief, I don't know that you got to win it. You just have to show that there's enough, you know, under these exceptional circumstances to then revisit the finality of the order, open it back up, and then go and litigate the things that should be resolved. I don't know that the motion hearing on the 60B hearing is the full evidentiary hearing. It seems like if that were the case, then they would effectively give themselves 60B relief because they'd relitigate everything at that time, right? I mean, so they're making a showing at that point. They've got an affidavit. I don't know, is there a specific response to the 10% bump, which is the chief's question? I mean, what's the state of the record insofar as it exists at this preliminary showing as it relates to the 60B motion?
As it relates to the 60B motion, I believe that the state of the record is both they have an affidavit from Robert Mack that doesn't talk about this 10% only to him. That's conclusions they draw that aren't supported by the increase in value from around $6 million when the inventory is first filed, which is SR-132, to the $7 million that it's valued at the time of this petition for distribution. So there's evidence within the record that this artificial 10% isn't artificial at all, because Eric Mack by affidavit is saying we're giving him one-fifth. He's not saying that we're giving him artificially inflated values so we get more. And he's telling the court that what they did was fair. And the backdrop between these two individuals, there's 5-6 different proceedings that have happened over the last 6 years in this estate. Robert Mack lacks credibility. Eric Mack has not lost credibility with the court.
At the 60B hearing, Robert's there saying, my attorney did something inappropriate and I want relief from that order, correct?
Correct.
And your position was you're not entitled to relief from the order. They attempted to explain why they thought the order was unfair. Were you expecting that the court was going to resolve the merits of that issue at that hearing?
No.
But the court did resolve that.
Yes.
Would you have handled it differently if you thought that was the actual hearing? Would you have presented something different?
As far as the valuations?
Yes.
I don't think so, because once we jump back into doing valuations of all these assets, then we're going beyond what 60B is supposed to do. 60B offers relief from the original judgment, but it doesn't allow you to relitigate the issues within that judgment. And this judgment, this order, provided the values within.
Why do you say that? 60B relief doesn't allow you to relitigate the matters in the final judgment. That is 60B relief.
Well, reading the law in Lowe v. Schwartz and the Hiller v. Hiller case, an appeal from, or it does not allow relitigation of issues that have been resolved by the judgment. Instead, it refers to some change in conditions that makes continued enforcement inequitable. So we're not looking at relitigating, we're looking at a change in circumstances that makes it inequitable. And in view of this case, I think that looks like a scenario where we still have these values and Robert Mack's arguing over what one-fifth of the values he gets.
So if I could, please. So what's a home run look like for, under that view, what's a home run look like for Robert Mack?
I think the home run for Robert Mack is he wins this appeal, and the appeal is...
No, I mean, what's it look like at the 60B stage?
Yes, at the 60B stage was, okay, now you get to argue about which one-fifth of the $7 million we've already decided is the estate assets.
Exactly.
Right. So he gets to pick a different quarter of land, or he wants to try to pick a different quarter of land.
Well, he can litigate that.
He can litigate over that quarter, but not over the values of those quarters. Looking at Eric Mack's opinion or affidavit, you can also see that we describe that Robert's actually getting a distribution that gives him the most farm ground tillable acres in this quarter. It also gives him an opportunity to add the quarter next to him because that's the quarter going up for sale. So the beneficiary, Robert Mack, was not being treated unfairly. He actually was getting a deal that gives him the best opportunity to have.
But their point is kind of narrower than that. Mr. Mack's point is, hey, give me a chance to have a hearing to talk about whether this is in fact a just or unjust ruling or not. That's all I'm asking for is a hearing where a lawyer comes in and represents me rather than saying I've consented to this. That's a little narrower. You're kind of getting into the, and I get it, and maybe that's part of the assessment that we look at in terms of whether the court abuses discretion when it said this isn't unjust.
Right. And it's difficult to not get outside of what I think the 60B motion allows because of the arguments going towards both valuation and not getting the quarter he wanted. So trying to respond to both of those different arguments, there is a look at what he actually got, how it equates to the other beneficiaries, and that it is fair and not unjust. So stepping outside of where the 60B motion goes is a line that's kind of unclear that requires this court to decide where to draw that line on what we're supposed to look at. But I see I'm out of time. If I can just wrap up quick.
Wrap up.
Before we get to this legal issue, there has to be a factual determination that Robert Mack's version is true. There has to be a determination by the trial court that Attorney Donahoe did commit fraud against him. That does not exist in the record. That is not a finding of fact, and it wasn't clear error for the court to find that he didn't believe the story. And the estate respectfully asks this court to affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Mr. Parsons, at some point, would you address Mr. Erickson's view of the scope of a 60B motion and what relief should look like, please?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has made clear that in resolving a 60B motion, the trial court's discretion is to be exercised liberally in accord with legal and equitable principles to promote the ends of justice. When you file a Rule 60B motion, you have to show that one of the prongs applies, and here it's the catch-all provision because fraud by one's own attorney has been the case to show that's where that fits. It's well within the heartland of Section 6. So what happens when you file a Rule 60B motion, you have to show that you're within the one-year time limit. That's the time limit. After that, you can't file it. And in estate of Sedlicek, this court was signaled we would have granted this. Justice Wolman wrote a concurrence talking about how terrible this was, that the attorney kept his own client in the dark about the settlement that was occurring in court. Very similar circumstances, but they could not grant it because it wasn't it was filed after 1 year. So the finality of judgments, you have to meet the time limit. You have to fit under one of the prongs, and we fit under Section 6, I think, very clearly. And then it's a question of what do the ends of justice require? It's really an equitable determination.
So what if your opposing counsel is saying the court had to make a finding that a fraud occurred, and if we've been talking at length about how to interpret this not-so-clear writing, and if in the end the court didn't really make a finding and it said I'm not sure, what do we do about that?
It sounds like that's in and of itself is reversible error if the court made no finding.
But then what happens?
I assume the court would remand with instructions to reconsider the Rule 60B motion. I don't think that's what the court should do. I think it should remand with instructions to grant it, because I believe we've met our burden. The court had, as you pointed out, Justice Devaney, the court was very careful to say, I'm not making a finding on that. I don't know. But it based its decision on two errors of law. The first, that one-fifth is one-fifth without regard to evidence or without regard to one-fifth of what. And the second was the court said there was prejudice to the beneficiaries because more proceedings would just take more time.
If we rule in your favor on the 60B part of it, do you think we also should affirm the court in saying that the distribution was fair and equitable? You weren't expecting that, were you? You weren't expecting the court to make that ruling that day.
No, I think that must be reversed, Your Honor, if the court reverses, so we can have our hearing. That is the question.
And when you presented the affidavits, you weren't presenting that with the expectation that the court was going to use those affidavits as a substitute evidentiary hearing.
No, we have to make a prima facie showing of a colorable claim, a probable meritorious defense might be another way to put it, where we can show we have cast substantial doubt on this through affidavit, through evidence, through documentary evidence, through financial records that we put into the record as part of this affidavit.
So you were trying to win it all. You were trying to obtain relief that ultimately you hoped would lead to setting aside the judgment.
That's what a Rule 60 vote.
Right, and that leads me back to the issue of the court had to look at make some preliminary determination of, is this guy telling the truth in terms of what happened with his lawyer? And is the result unjust? I mean, because we don't just open these up every time somebody files a motion for 60B relief.
Right.
And so there does have to be. So respond to your suggestion that the court's not going to look at all the merits. There's got to be some preliminary determination.
Absolutely.
And the court made that.
But does the court need to do that if the court makes an adverse credibility assessment? Assume a valid adverse credibility assessment. The court doesn't need to get into the merits then. I don't believe this happened. We're done.
Yeah, if I'm making an evidentiary finding that this did not happen based on facts and evidence, I guess, yeah, it'd be over.
But though our standards are deferential for trial court sitting as fact finders, clear error, of course, is our standard. Credibility determinations could conceivably be reviewed on their merits, and a credibility determination could conceivably be outside the range of permissible choices.
Well, and particularly a credibility
discussion we could be left with a firm commitment that a mistake has been made, right, under clear error.
Particularly a credibility determination based on paper. If this was a credibility determination, it was based on a paper record.
And how does the court factor in, if we're making that assessment, is it appropriate to factor in the fact that approximately 2 weeks after this hearing, the attorney involved was suspended for medical reasons from practicing law?
That makes it pretty believable. And, I won't go on. It's very believable that this attorney, in the position he was in, was not responsive. And that was the testimony, the representations by the other attorneys at the hearing for the other side. We couldn't get a hold of this guy. We've tried, and so that's why this, the reason Bob found out, the way he found out this order had been entered, this hearing had taken place, and this petition had been filed, is Mr. Foley, who was one of the attorneys for the estate, could not get a hold, and this is in the record, could not get a hold of Bob's former attorney, and so he went directly to Bob to try to get him to sign these deeds. And Bob said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Oh yeah, we had this hearing that this is what you're getting in the estate." And Bob was, "What? No one ever told." That's when he called Ms. Ryder, Attorney Ryder. I mean, that's in the record. That's how Bob found out that Mr. Foley could not get a hold of.
And to be clear, if I could please, in a word, real quick.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry. To be clear, so in determining credibility, sometimes someone will say this occurred, and someone will say this did not occur. And the court has to weigh that and determine what, in fact, the facts are. We don't have that corresponding sort of, oh, yes, you did get notice. We have, I didn't get notice, and then we have a litany of other things that are not flattering that then become a credibility determination.
Right.
But we don't have a corresponding set of evidentiary markers that we can say, oh yeah, you did get notice, and now I'm resolving this factual conflict sitting in my unique role as a fact finder.
Sounds like a yes or no question.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you, lawyers, for the argument in this case. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.